Today on The Grave Talks, the wide world of the paranormal, a conversation with Steve Ward. ...1960s Michigan. Teenage boys were engrossed in the fantasy comic book land of alien beings and other science fiction. Steve Ward was one of those teens. Until one day, much to his surprise, suddenly nearby communities began reporting unexplained UFO phenomena and other supernatural encounters. Although he couldn't yet drive, this didn't stop Steve from beginning his journey to better understand what was going on in the real world that very much resembled what was being represented in the comic books he loved to read by flashlight.
Well, you know, I think I envy those people that call themselves experiencers a little bit, although some of the experiences sound like something I would not want to partake of. But for me, it was, an early interest in science fiction, that kind of thing. But that sort of led me to, you know, the so-called real strange experiences. You recall the books of Frank Edwards. He had those great anthologies, Stranger Than Science, Strangest of All, way back in the 60s, I think. And also followed up by books like Jim and Coral Lorenzen. They were the ones that founded APRO, which was one of the early UFO organizations, a serious organization. That was the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. And they wrote some great books called UFO Occupants and so forth. So these are some of the they kind of broke tradition with some of the earlier some of the other early researchers like Donald Kehoe, that we know from NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. Early on, it seemed like some of the early researchers didn't want to get into the stranger stuff. They were happy to talk about these strange craft going around, flying around in the sky all day. But boy, when you started talking about the humanoids, the occupants stepping out of them, they didn't want to go there. But the Lorenzens did. And I found those all fascinating. But then when I was in, I was junior high, it was mid 60s, and grew up in Michigan. And we had the what has been dubbed the swamp gas sightings. And that was March of 1966. We had this incredible flap of UFO reports. A lot of very credible people, a lot of police officers were seeing these things. There was one that a lot of witnesses saw landed apparently on the Frank Manor Farm in Dexter, Michigan, which is right near Ann Arbor, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so this stuff is going on in my backyard, yeah. You know. So it doesn't get much cooler than that, although I couldn't drive, so I couldn't play UFO investigator. But that year, the other thing that really kind of formed my interest, if you follow all the way to the next November, that was one of the first sightings of the strange winged humanoid creature with red glowing eyes. They dubbed the Mothman in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Yeah. So you add all that up together. And I'm afraid I've never looked back.
Yeah. What exactly, you know, as a kid, when you're hearing these stories and this stuff is in your backyard, essentially, I totally get it. I grew up in Wisconsin. I lived in Michigan, too, for a period of time. And there's just, I don't know, there's and we can talk about this a little bit later, but there's something about those areas of the country that, you know, they're warm and inviting and they're beautiful, but there's also something kind of spooky about them. When it comes to your interest and what really just kind of drove you into it with the stuff being in your backyard, what elements of it really, really spoke to you? Was it more of the aspect of, well, this isn't just like a craft or something? Did it end up being more of something along the lines of who are these beings that we're coming across?
Yes, I was fascinated by all that. Now, see, early on, now my thinking has changed very much over the years. And researchers like John Keel, who wrote The Mothman Prophecies, Jacques Vallée, who wrote Passport to Magonia, of course, they both wrote many other books. They really changed my thinking later on. But back then, I, like so many other people, I started out believing that these things had to be extraterrestrial. I mean, what else could they be, right? And they seemed to fit that pattern. And it was just, it was fascinating to me to think that we were actually being visited, you know, that science fiction was a reality and that we were actually being visited by these creatures that were, you know, seemed to be taking soil samples sometimes. The abduction experience wasn't talked about too much back then, but nevertheless, people would be taken aboard their craft or be invited aboard. And, you know, all this just seemed to be plausible and just really fascinating. But later on, I came to, people might think evolve or maybe devolve. And my thinking changed quite a bit with some of these other ideas.
Let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, because obviously with anything, when you get this information, what the heck is this? This is something new. I mean, this happens with regular news cycles. When something breaks, there's a lot of information that's not accurate right at the beginning. But the same would be true of something like this. When suddenly people are reporting these things nearby, you know, you're going to get a lot of hearsay and conjecture. How did that journey go for you? How did your line of thinking move from, okay, everybody's saying this is an extraterrestrial, to where did it go exactly?
I'll tell you where it went in a second. But another thing I wanted to point out, you bring up this great era, because back then, some of these things were actually, I mean, you still had the newscast where they would, you know, take these things tongue in cheek. But even the classic Betty and Barney Hill encounter, early 1960s, the couple that was abducted in New Hampshire, and that everybody, I'm sure just about everybody that's listening knows about, that was actually covered seriously, even if skeptically, in Look magazine and so forth. The Ann Arbor sightings were taken at least seriously to a point. So, but then later on, you know, it kind of, you know how that has changed, and maybe it's gone back again. But for me, I had been exposed to the writings of John Keel. Again, John Keel is probably best known for the Mothman prophecies.
Sure.
Well, back in early 70s, I guess, he wrote a book called Strange Creatures from Time and Space. It had this great Frank Frazetta painting on the cover. If anybody knows who Frank Frazetta, the artist, is, will know that it's just a classic cover. Now, later on, not to be confusing, but that book has gone through an evolution where it's now called The Guide to Mysterious Beings. And I think it's in trade paper size. So that's where Keel first proposed this idea that he called window areas. Now, some people will say portals or vortexes or whatever. Ivan Sanderson called them vile vortices, which is a great term. But Keel was trying to come to grips with, you know, why is it these things seem to sort of pop in and pop out? I mean, a lot of credible people will see a Bigfoot, but they just kind of show up and then they take off, even close to some, you know, very highly populated areas. Now, then later on, the book that really messed me up was called UFOs Operation Trojan Horse. And that's where Keel had actually, he had left the extraterrestrial hypothesis behind, although later on he left the door open a little bit. The idea here is that I believe that there's not one answer to these things. But in Trojan Horse, Keel pulls all these things together. He really demonstrated that there are connections between classic UFO experiences, some cryptid reports, poltergeist phenomena, classic haunting phenomena, and that they seem to be inseparable. Now, I was not real happy with that at first, because I was very content with the idea that aliens were coming here from Zeta Reticuli or wherever. And I've always thought of these other things as being separate. But that book really, really demonstrated that there did seem to be connections, even with folklore. And speaking of folklore, the next book I read, you know, I'm barely recovering from Trojan Horse and kind of starting to accept some of those ideas. And then I read Jacques Vallée's Passport to Magonia, where he demonstrates that various traditions of folklore and some modern day UFO experiences seem to be inseparable, or at least seem to have a common source. And I'm not suggesting that that leprechauns are driving flying saucers, or that UFO pilots, modern-day UFO pilots, used to sport little green tunics and wear little red caps. But there seems to be, if you look at the work of Jacques Vallée and more recently Joshua Kuchin in Thieves in the Night, it seems like there's a commonality there. So that's kind of where that was the main turning point for me, is reading the they're books by these guys, and it just really kind of turned my world upside down. But once you're exposed to that, it's very hard to go back.
What were some of the connections that were made between the world of UFOs, cryptoids, things like that, and ghosts that really spoke to you that you operate by now?
Well, there's I probably won't be able to pull them all up at once, but for example, people talk about cameras jamming, batteries draining in haunted house phenomena.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing has happened in encrypted reports. For example, Ron Moorhead, who is a famous Bigfoot researcher. He's the one that captured the Sierra sounds out in the Sierra Nevadas back in the early 70s. He's had, in more recent years, he's had trouble with trying to make recordings and so forth because his batteries will drain.
Mm-hmm.
F.W. Holliday, who investigated the Loch Ness Monster and came to the conclusion that this thing was probably not a flesh and blood creature, but was something more psychic or some kind of almost like an apparition. The same thing, camera jamming, batteries draining, and so forth. When you look at the occupants and so forth, you have this sometimes a marked similarity between modern day UFO pilots and what we used to think of as the good people or the fairies, the elementals, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you a classic case that pulls a lot of these things together. You were from Wisconsin. Do you remember the Joe Symington case, the cosmic pancakes from outer space?
I don't.
Oh, okay. This is early mid 60s. Joe Symington is a plumber by trade, and he's a chicken farmer by day. He's got a little chicken farm on his property.
Mm-hmm.
He hears this strange noise outside. Goes out. He sees this craft, kind of a classic saucer shaped craft that has just hovering above the ground. He walks up. The door is open, and he sees these people in there. They're about 5 feet tall. They're wearing coveralls, something that looks like a cap or a knit cap. And one of them hands him sort of a silver chalice, like a bowl or whatever, and through hand gestures, it seems to indicate that he wants water.
Mm-hmm.
So Joe goes to his well. And he pumps it, puts some water in there, and hands it to him. Now he notices inside this small craft, there's one of them looks like he's cooking something on a flameless grill, and they look like pancakes or cookies or something like that. So they give him a few of these in exchange for the water. This is sort of like something out of classic fairy lore, the exchange you're supposed to not eat the food from fairyland because you may never come back. Mm-hmm. So. Then they take off. Well, the thing is, he reports this. Project Blue Book investigated this. Even Dr. Jalen Hynek, and this is the real Dr. Hynek, not the caricature they did on the show not too long ago. And everybody thinks that Joe is telling the truth, as he knows it. Now there's all kinds of things that kind of spread out from this. There's a local judge there that knows Joe and believes he's credible, but he interviews him. His judge has some interest in the UFO phenomenon, and a little tongue in cheek, his first question, he says, "Joe, what do these guys look like?" Mm-hmm. And little green men. And Joe says, "No, Judge, they were kind of swarthy looking, like Italians." And I think, okay, I don't think Italians have some kind of a secret space program, but when you follow this thread. John Keel in Trojan Horse uncovered a really bizarre news conference that General Spatz gave about 1948. General Spatz was one of the big generals in World War II.
Sure.
In part of this conference, he says, there's no truth to the rumor, and I don't know if he's kidding or what the context is. There's no truth to the rumor that Spaniards are being seen in flying saucers. So Keel. Now, this is, again, this is another thread. This is before the Grays showed up. The Grays didn't really show up in mass until, say, late 70s, early 80s, with the advent of Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Whitley Strieber's book, Communion. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, you could barely find anything that looked like a gray. There was quite a variety. But Kiel was getting reports from people that believed that they saw landings and entities step out that looked very, their descriptions were not terribly sophisticated. They would say things like, well, they look kind of European. They were sort of dark foreign types, which, you know, perhaps we're talking about that somebody would think looked like swarthy Italians or Spaniards. Even another segue, if you get into some of the Men in Black phenomena, some of those characters, although some of them have different characteristics, also kind of fit that pattern. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is that if you look at this incident in modern day, and let's say it really happened, we would say, well, it's probably E.T., even though it doesn't make any sense. I mean, what are they doing with a flameless grill? I mean, don't they have freeze-dried food? Why would they need an external source of water? Whether they need to drink it or examine it? It just doesn't make any sense. Like so many cases don't make any sense. If this happened 100 or 200 years ago, they would have said Joe had been visited by the fairies. But here's where it gets even weirder. The Project Blue Book, for whatever reason, used taxpayers' money to examine these pancakes that Joe received. And they're just like normal pancakes, except there's one ingredient was missing, salt. And of course, salt was supposed to be, Jacques Vallée quoted as a source, he used a book called The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries. This was written by Evans Wentz. Evans Wentz went around Ireland in the early 1900s. The book came out in 1911. And he talked to people one-on-one about their experiences with the good people, the fairies, the elementals. And these are experiences like we go along around and talk to people. And these weren't all handed down, you know, from stories in the family. These are things that supposedly really happened. Well, one of the Irishmen that Wentz talked to said the fairies take fresh meat. They drink pure water, but they never take salt. So that was, you know, salt is kind of a protection against the forces of evil or some of these negative elements.
Yeah.
And then if you can follow another thread here where it's common that people have seen UFOs collecting water. Ingo Swann, who is was the great psychic that helped develop the remote viewing program for the military, he was with a clandestine group, supposedly. They saw a triangular-shaped UFO over a lake literally suck water up into it. There's a classic case in Ontario where a couple over a rise were looking down on a lake. They saw a saucer floating on the water. They had there was a hose in the water where it was sucking up water from the lake. And then here's again, we get really weird and kind of retro again. About 53, I think, Brush Creek, California. John Black and his partner, they're miners. And over the past month, they've been seeing this strange craft go overhead. But they're there to do a job. They're not concerned about it. They think, well, maybe it's some kind of military craft that they don't know about. So at one time, John is in the woods. He sees what he thinks is a little kid fishing by the stream. He gets closer, and this kid is not a kid. It's something else. He's wearing a little sort of a tunic with buckles and a tie. He's bending over with a bucket retrieving water. So Black holds back, watches this entity go out of the woods, go across a clearing, and climb up a ladder into a craft similar to what they've been seeing for the last month. Again, a report of some kind of an entity gathering water in a bucket. So, you know, you get more and more into some of these, and it's very hard to decide whether the fairies came to visit. And remember, when you get into the lore of the fairies, they were not these benign little Tinkerbells. They could be real nasty. And the reason that they would call them the good people and other benign names was to try and be sure they did not incur their wrath. But here's another instance. When you get into the Mothman, for example, there was a Swedish researcher that followed Kiel's footsteps. I can't think of his name right now. But he interviewed several of the Mothman witnesses. Almost to a witness, every one of them that had seen this winged apparition, whatever it was, experienced an outbreak of poltergeist phenomena in their house. Many people that see UFO reports will see orbs or have poltergeist outbreaks in their house. And I can go on. There's John Keel had this sort of a catchphrase, and it was ask the contactee or the experiencer what he or she had for breakfast. And what he meant was find out about the individual. And if you like, I can give you an example of a lady that had an abduction experience that I can tell you about that kind of illustrates this.
Yeah.
A lady contacted me a few years ago on Facebook, and she and her husband live out in New Hampshire. And one morning, now this is okay. Well, I won't get ahead of myself. So one morning they're standing there on the front porch early. They live near an airport, so they're very familiar with the lights and what they look like, the normal craft. But something looked really odd. It was coming toward them, and then all of a sudden, they're not standing next to each other. They're on opposite sides of the porch, and they look up and they see this large, giant black triangle passing overhead, so low that it's brushing the tops of the trees. And then, like in many, and I'm sure you've heard of cases like this, people experience something very odd, and then it's like, oh, well, that's interesting. And then they went back to bed.
Yeah.
Later on, they think, well, heck, why did we do that? And
yeah.
And then she realized, well, you know, we're missing about a half hour.
Yeah.
So she was she contacted me before she made the breakthrough finding out what may have happened to her. But in the meantime, I asked her a series of questions that people like John Keel would have asked. And that was and to make a long story short, it turned out that she and her family had been experiencing classic haunting phenomena in her house. Both her sons were experiencing orb phenomena, some right in the house. One came up to her older son and circled him and then took off. The younger son would see these things, these golden balls sort of floating around and dancing outside his window at night. She also experienced shadow people. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, mm-hmm. in her research, discovered that when she was investigating shadow people, she found out that a significant percentage of people, and she didn't expect this, were also experiencing classic alien abduction phenomena. And then I asked this young lady, I said, well, you know, this is going to sound like a weird question, but have you ever seen anything like a Bigfoot or some kind of unusual animal? And she said, well, no. And then she said, oh, wait a minute. My mother-in-law and sister-in-law on the property here saw something really strange. And this was seen a couple different times on our property. And it was described as a sort of a panther-like creature, but standing on two legs. Many people that have these experiences, if you ask the right questions. Also, Keel found out they would have electronic problems in their house. They would get mysterious phone calls static on the phone or robotic type voices.
Yeah.
Of course, sometimes they would get strange visitors, which might fall under the general Men in Black category. So the more you get into it, and it's perfectly all right, I think, to specialize in different areas. But I think some people resist, as I did early on, the idea that some of these things can be connected with other aspects of the paranormal.
Sure. Let me ask you this, and this is, you know, I want to understand what your take is. This is 100% an opinion-based question, and I'm sure it probably goes in 50 different directions, because that's how I've been, obviously, over the years too, where, you know, you get into it and you think, oh, I'll get a better understanding of this, and you end up with far more questions than you do
exactly.
Answers. But just take me down the road of what it is for you, knowing all these things and everything that you've learned from others' research, and then from what you've heard personally from people, when you're connecting those dots with folks that seem to have some sort of activity, whether it originates with what one would consider kind of a classic UFO encounter, what one would consider to be a shadow person or a ghostly encounter, and then you dig a little deeper and you find out the frequency at which these people are experiencing paranormal events in the genericest of terms of, well, they got ghosts, but they also seem to be having this, 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 and this. How does this all connect for you. Is this something that we are talking about as a whole, is some sort of alien being or something, some other group of entities that are coming in and visiting us, and they have, you know, one hell of a power that represents themselves, or we interpret as ghosts? Or are we leaning more down the direction of this is more interdimensional, ghostly type thing that we would consider in that realm, but some folks interpret it more as UFOs? Really, almost, in my opinion, kind of comes down to a point of reference and what you're most comfortable believing. If UFOs are more your thing, you're going to think a lot of these are UFO or alien type things. If ghosts is more your thing or comfort level, you're going to think whatever's paranormal is going to be more ghostly. What is it? Where do you think this all kind of falls at the end of the day?
Boy, just nothing but he's just throwing these easy questions.
500 questions in one.
but that's right. You've hit it. Yeah. John Keel wrote, "Belief is the enemy." Yeah. You know, if you believe in the devil, he's going to come down the street and knock on your door. If you believe in E.T., they're going to jump out of that little egg-shaped craft and start collecting rocks and plants and so forth. And my thinking is not static. And I get caught in this kind of a logic loop where I get pulled around, you know, one way toward the paranormal at some times, and then other evidence suggests, well, no, this is much more physical, and I feel like I'm caught in a whirlpool with backwash and eddies and so forth. But I've gone, the pendulum has swung both ways.
Yeah.
Early on, when I discovered Keel and Vallée, I was convinced that there was no E.T., there were no crash saucers, and this was simply, well, that Keel talked about transmogrifications of energy, that there was certainly an energy or intelligence there, but it was reflective. It could mimic our consciousness and kind of manifest it, sort of like a little bit like Carl Jung and his collective unconscious, only it's really manifesting. And the idea there would be, he thought perhaps the only really real thing about this. Again, his thinking wasn't static and it didn't stay in one place. But the only reality might be these strange meandering lights. In other words, if you go back in history and people would see the lights moving in the sky, well, they were, the Chinese called them dragon tracks. And in another era, when people believed that witches had powers and could actually fly on brooms, that was, of course, the lantern they were carrying. In another era, it would be, of course, the fairies, the little people, and they were fairy lights. Even in the late 1800s, early 1900s, people were talking about these majestic airships. Well, they didn't always see a physical craft. A lot of times they'd see a light, and they would assume that it was that craft. And then you had the Foo Fighters, and you still have strange orbs and that nowadays. Is it the same phenomena manifesting or appearing in different ways? And Keel was not too interested in what did the craft look like? How many portholes did it have? He wasn't interested in that. He wasn't interested in what the creature looked like, because he suspected that certain people were being programmed or experiencing things where it was just sort of manifesting or projecting in a certain way to fulfill their to kind of connect with their consciousness or wherever they were at. But he wasn't saying that there were illusions or hallucinations. There was a real there was a paraphysicality to it. Okay. So there's something to that. There is we don't have enough time to get into it, but there is something, there is this reflective factor. There is something that when, again, you look at the evolution of some of these so-called craft, it's always like they were a little bit ahead of where we were. When the airships were being seen, either dirigibles didn't exist or zeppelins, or they were in a very, very infant stage. The more you go on, there does seem to me to be also I guess you could call it, like, Albert Rosales has written those, has that huge database on humanoids. Those books, the subtitle is The Others Amongst Us. There does seem to be some kind of a presence, some kind of an intelligence. Keeping in mind that when we categorize the way different craft looks presently and has looked, when we categorize the entities, Greys and the other aliens or whatever they are, there's very, very seldom any that are exactly the same. It's almost like there's this sort of a general, there's no cookie cutter. There's sort of this general concept, and they just manifest in different ways. So to make a long story short, what I have come to believe now is I have been on both sides of the fence, but I don't reject either one now. I think that we are possibly dealing with some other intelligence, whether it's from off-world or another dimension or whatever. Mm-hmm. But there's also this mechanism in human consciousness that can be reflective. This would explain, we have some Bigfoot sightings that appear to be flesh and blood, leave hair samples, footprints, and so forth. But then you have the really bizarre Bigfoot reports that occurred in 73, 74 in southwestern Pennsylvania that Stan Gordon covered in conjunction with UFOs and strange lights. So what if, you know, there's this mechanism in human consciousness where you have some real physical UFOs, some real physical cryptids, but there's something that mimics them or whatever. So we get this, the true and the counterfeit. But here's my sort of half-baked conclusion that what might change 5 minutes from now. I suspect that there is this intelligence, and that if there is, they're perfectly aware of this mechanism in human consciousness. And if they are, perhaps they can exploit it. They can, through the force of their will or technology, they can manipulate us using that aspect in our collective unconscious and, you know, hide their activities or deceive us in what they're doing. There's one other thing that I should mention, that when you get into a lot of this stuff, you look at the, for example, the Skinwalker Ranch out in Utah. Mm-hmm. And everybody that is familiar with the TV show and the book, The Hunt for the Skinwalker, if you isolate certain aspects of it, you could say, oh, it's ET, it's extra-dimensional. When you look at the thing as a whole, you know, they experienced disembodied voices, poltergeist-like phenomena, cattle not just being mutilated but being displaced. So there's a real sort of a negative aspect or trickster element to a lot of this. And if there is a real trickster element to some of this, that kind of suggests to me that there is some aspect of consciousness involved. And so I know that's pretty confusing, but I think we have to come to grips with both. I mean, the paranormal aspect is something that needs to be dealt with, but I don't think we can reject the entire notion that there are real physical entities with whatever their purpose is. And perhaps we have a grand central station full of these different types of entities. I don't know,
yeah.
But it would seem to make sense that they would be aware of this aspect within us that could create these sort of phantasms, so to speak.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Steve Ward about the wide world of the paranormal. To hear part two of our conversation, become a gravekeeper. You do it at thegravetalks.com. Click Become a Gravekeeper. In part two, is there a connection between alien-like creatures and the spirits of the once living? What exactly are orbs? Are there different types of orbs from different sources, both ghostly and otherworldly? Are encounters increasing or decreasing in our world? Or are they the same? And how much do various governments of the world know about the unexplained, supernatural, paranormal, cryptoid, you name it? What do they know that we do not? Be sure to check out Steve's podcast, The High Strangeness Factor, on Paranormal UK Radio. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.